This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With heat records already crashing around the world, scientists are predicting an El Niño this winter. It's time for this Radio EcoShock replay on El Niño and everything it means, first broadcast in 2014. Will 2018 be the hottest year in human history? Will the Pacific Ocean changeup called El Niño startle the world? I'll speak with ocean climate expert Shane McGregor and report on the situation along with my surprising conclusion. But stick around for the final interview. We'll go from fear to action with Luke Kimmel and the Leaf Ninjas. They are transforming a city one backyard at a time with success in urban agriculture and neo-green job creation. Luke has good tips for you. But we start with the story of the day, El Niño, first with the latest report from NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They issued a new update on El Niño this past Thursday. Mike Halpert serves as the acting director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland. He's co-authored articles on climate variability and prediction. He's worked with ENSO and seasonal forecast teams. Mike Halpert, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
So what is the latest prediction from the National Weather Service about whether we will get an El Niño?
Today we issued our latest ENSO diagnostics discussion, and we continue to be issuing what we term El Niño watches. So it means that conditions remain favorable for El Niño to develop. Probably the biggest update to this is that we're more confident at this point that El Niño will develop at some point, with the probabilities now exceeding a 65% during the summer months.
Yes, we had a problem in 2012 when it looked like an El Niño might shape up, but then it didn't. Are we finding better ways to make these predictions?
You know, really the models and the statistical tools haven't really changed that much over the past few years. I think one of the things that gives us maybe a little more confident that this year El Niño will develop is that the incipient factors, what we're seeing below the surface of the ocean, are considerably stronger than what we saw in 2012. So even though we did peak out at a 75% chance that El Niño would develop back in, I guess that would have been in the fall of 2012, we're seeing a stronger setup at this point. So we're a little more confident that El Niño will develop.
And there are a range of possibilities for El Niño, from sort of weak to strong. Do we have indications on that?
You know, at this point, that's still premature. We are really still in what we term the spring predictability barrier, or basically this is still kind of the minimum time of year for historical skill. Having said that, like I said, the subsurface is quite favorable for El Niño to develop, so we do think that will happen, but strength-wise, we're probably still a couple months away from when we'll have a better handle on that.
Why should Americans care whether an El Niño arrives later this year?
El Niño has really global impacts. It's such a disruption in the atmospheric circulation over the Pacific that really the impacts ripple globally. For the U.S., should El Niño to develop over the next couple of months, it could certainly have an impact on the upcoming hurricane seasons. In particular, El Niño oftentimes helps to suppress hurricane activity in the Atlantic Basin. So that would be a good thing for those folks living in coastal areas. Of course, it still only takes one hurricane to get you. So whether you have fewer total storms, you still have to prepare if you're living in an area that's susceptible to tropical cyclone activity. Or once we kind of get through the hurricane season, the next real significant impacts over the United States would be next winter. Oftentimes, El Niño is associated with wetter than average conditions across the southern tier of the U.S., in particular from Texas to Florida, but in the strong cases, oftentimes in California, and obviously given the very strong and severe drought that's ongoing right now in California, I think a nice rainy season next winter would certainly be quite welcome. We oftentimes also see milder conditions across parts of the U.S., in particular the northern parts. And again, I would say after the winter that we've just experienced in those areas, they might be appreciative of a break as well.
I'm wondering, too, and I know the weather's becoming more unpredictable, as the recent report from the U.S. government tells us, but could an El Nino bring a relief from that sort of polar vortex winter that we had last year in North America?
You know, that is kind of hard to say. Those are two phenomena that are kind of maybe work on different atmospheric phenomena. If you go back to the last El Nino we saw, which would have been in the winter of 2009-10, it was also one, while we didn't have the severe cold, it did see a lot of snow up and down the East Coast. And that really was kind of a combination of the El Nino providing the enhanced storminess down to the south and a different phenomena, something called the Arctic Oscillation, being in its negative phase, which allowed cold air to infiltrate the central and eastern part of the nation, and combined with that moisture resulted in quite a snowy winter from the D.C. area northward.
There's a new article in New Scientist, actually it's an editorial, saying that governments should be preparing people for an El Nino. What sort of preparations can we take anyway?
You know, some of the simple things that a homeowner might do if you're living in an area that's likely to see or potentially will see heavy rainfall could be simple things like clearing out your storm drains, clearing out your gutters to make sure that the water that does fall on your roofs runs away. If you're thinking, if it's about time for a new roof, if you're living in California, well, it might be appropriate to get it before the winter rather than after. There was actually a fairly remarkable comparison to the two big El Nino events that we've seen over the past 30 years, the 1982-83 event compared to the 1997-98 event. Back in 82-83, the El Nino was really unforecast and caught everybody by surprise. 97-98 was clear due to advancements in monitoring as well as models that we were going to see a very significant event as early as the summer months. Word was provided out to California and really much of to the U.S., but in particular California, they did some estimates and they claimed that the early warning and preparedness that they were able to do before the rains came in 97 saved them roughly $1 billion compared to the losses and damages back in 82-83.
Does climate change have an impact on El Nino? I mean, they've been happening for thousands of years, but has climate change, will it change it?
You know, that's an open question at this point. You're right, El Nino, you said thousands. I think some people say El Ninos go back tens and hundreds of thousands of years. So El Nino has certainly been a part of the normal cycle of the Pacific Ocean. At this point, there's no evidence that El Nino is changing as a result of climate change, but it is still something that we're looking at fairly closely.
So what will scientists be watching for in months to come?
Well, for those of us that track and predict El Nino, we'll certainly be looking for the surface to continue to warm. It has warmed modestly over the past month or two. If it continues to warm at some point in the next couple of months, we'll probably go from our El Nino watch to issuing El Nino advisories. But what will play the largest role in the development in this event will be how that above average ocean water starts to interact with the atmosphere above it. If we start to see the winds and the patterns of sea level pressure, and in particular the patterns of tropical rainfall start to shift as well, that's when we'll be quite confident that certainly we're going to see an El Nino that will have impacts, and then we'll have to look out and see how strong it potentially could become.
Where can listeners go to get further updates on El Nino?
The Climate Prediction Center website, www.cpc.noaa.gov, is a good starting point. It's where we issue our ENSO discussion. We also have weekly products. We're also in the process of developing an ENSO blog that will be hosted on the NOAA Climate Portal. That's actually just climate.gov, and there should be a link up probably either later this week or early next week. And on the blog, we'll be providing some kind of news and features, but also it'll be an opportunity to interact and even answer some questions that folks out in that have climate interests and concerns would like to provide to us.
Our guest has been Mike Halpert, the acting director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland. Thank you so much for the update, Mike.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, reporting on the quiet panic about the coming storms, El Niño, what it is and what it isn't. Then stay tuned for Positive Steps from the Leaf Ninjas. Maybe you heard that a system called El Niño could further destabilize the weather and ring up another record hot year globally. The last big El Niño was in 1998, one of the hottest years on Earth, and a time of storms and firestorms in many parts of the world. The next may arrive soon. Scientists have been working furiously to find out how this weather system works. They also want to predict when an El Niño is coming. In the heart of that hunt is Dr. Shane McGregor. He's a research fellow at Australia's Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Dr. McGregor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the new science, let's cover a bit of the basics. What is El Niño?
So I think to understand El Niño, you need to first understand kind of the background conditions of the Pacific Ocean. So basically, the winds in the Pacific Ocean blow from east to west. Okay, and this causes a whole bunch of warm water to pile up in the western equatorial Pacific, and it makes the eastern equatorial Pacific quite cold. Now, during an El Niño event, that warm water that was normally piled up in the west sloshes back across the Pacific to the east and makes the whole equatorial Pacific, east and west, very warm.
Right, but then that becomes a complex system that appears to affect the rest of the world. So why should we care about what happens there in the Pacific? And why are governments and scientists racing to understand El Niño?
To answer the first part first, why do we care? The main thing is, so atmospheric convection, or like large-scale rainfall, occurs over the warm water. So when the warm water is piled up in the west, you have a whole bunch of kind of rainfall occurring in the western equatorial Pacific. During El Niño, when you move that warm water east, this rainfall kind of moves to the east as well. And in terms of the tropical Pacific, this rainfall is very important because it basically acts to fuel the atmospheric circulation cells. So basically, we're moving where we're putting this fuel into the atmosphere, which then in turn changes the atmospheric weather patterns around the globe.
And are there major and minor El Niño events?
Well, there's obviously like a whole spectrum of events, you know, so you can slosh just a little bit of the warm water from the west to the east, and you can slosh kind of all of it over. So there are definitely different magnitudes of events. And the interesting thing is there's kind of a distinction between the small ones and the big ones, and it's basically during a small one, you move the rainfall, the equatorial rainfall, from the west to about the central Pacific, and it's not warm enough to actually shift it the whole way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific. Whereas during the big El Niño events, the rainfall systems move from basically from New Guinea and can extend the whole way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific, so almost the South American coast.
Okay. Now, for me, an important point is that since the last big El Niño in 1998, we've spent 16 years pouring even greater record amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and at least half of that, we're told, is absorbed by the oceans. Can these added gases and heat add up to an even bigger El Niño event than we've had in the past?
So it's really hard to kind of specify one particular event as being due to global warming. You know, so El Niño events are a regularly occurring natural phenomenon that have been occurring for hundreds, even thousands of years, according to paleo records. So it's really hard to just say one individual event is going to be enhanced or dampened due to global warming. So, yeah, I can't really answer that question specifically saying, yes, this one's going to be super big because it's El Niño. But there has been some research saying that the chances of getting big El Niño events is going to increase as we move to a warmer climate.
Well, for the science, I'd like to begin by asking about a recent paper that you co-authored, and the title is Late 20th Century Emergence of the El Niño Propagation Asymmetry and Future Projections. Shane McGregor, what did your team of authors hope to do with that paper?
Okay, what we hope to do during El Niño events, and the way they have been observed in the past, most of the sea surface temperature changes start out in the eastern equatorial Pacific and then they move to the central equatorial Pacific. Whereas the really big El Niño events of 1982-83 and 1997-98 started in the central to western equatorial Pacific and moved eastward towards the west coast of South America. We set out to explain kind of why that happened, why those two events were so drastically different to the other ones in terms of their propagation characteristics. And then we kind of looked into what would happen to these kind of events in the future in regards to how ENSO is simulated in the climate models used in the current generation of IPCC models.
So in a language that someone without scientific training could understand, what are some of your conclusions?
The conclusions were that basically the events get so big, the current anomalies on the equatorial Pacific, like the surface winds, generally go from the east towards the west. For La Nina events and small El Nino events, the current anomalies still go that way. But for a big El Nino event, the changes in the currents are so strong that actually reverse these mean currents on the equator. And it's that fact that causes these events to propagate from west to east instead of from east to west.
So it's really a change in the current in the ocean is what you're saying?
Yeah, basically.
Well, now let's say I'm a government leader or an advisor. Does this new research help me prepare, or can we even prepare for such a big change in the global weather system?
That's a difficult question to answer. So in terms of just in forecasting El Nino events in general, one of the good things about them is, so basically the events are kind of starting to get initiated in the Northern Hemisphere summer is when the events will be initiated. They peak in the Northern Hemisphere winter, so around Christmas time they'll reach their peak magnitude, and then they kind of decay in the following spring. So once an event has started, you have a good idea how the event will play out. So regardless of the magnitude, you know the sea surface temperature anomalies will generally continue to grow until Christmas, and after which time they'll decay. So it gives, why scientists are so interested in it, and it gives us the ability to kind of enhance forecasts, so seasonal forecasts of rainfall and temperature for various regions.
In the Northern Hemisphere, say in America, we would start to look for this to build, say, in September and then peak in December. Is that what I'm getting from this?
Yeah. But so basically, so what we're seeing so far to date, I'm not sure if you're aware, they're actually anticipating or forecasting, you know, a 70% likelihood for an El Nino event to occur this coming Christmas. And what basically happens at the moment, there's kind of the initiation of the event appears to have been started. There's been these kind of big wind bursts in the equatorial region that have basically started sloshing the water from the west towards the east. Once the water gets to the east, it requires the atmosphere to respond to the changes in sea surface temperature, and then this acts to further enhance the changes in sea surface temperature. So it's kind of what we call a positive feedback. So once this positive feedback starts, and once you can see that it's actually happening, which should take place in the next several months, we should be there to then have a lot more confidence in our forecasts.
Well, let's follow up with a second letter published this past January in the journal Nature Climate Change. It's exactly what many of us worry about. The title is Increasing Frequency of Extreme El Nino Events Due to Greenhouse Warming. First of all, how would you describe an extreme El Nino event?
So like I said before, an extreme one is actually when the rainfall anomalies associated with the event move all of the way from so they're normally located in the western equatorial Pacific, and they move all of the way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific. So that's how they classify extreme ENSO events, but it's this rainfall response. So it's instead of putting heat up into the atmosphere, which drives the global circulation in the western equatorial Pacific, we're moving it a long way, like over 100 degrees in longitude to the east. This in itself will have dramatic changes for the global climate and weather patterns, obviously for a finite period, for, you know, a 6-month period or 12-month period while the event's occurring.
Now, do we have statistical facts showing that extreme El Niños are more frequent? And secondly, how do we know greenhouse warming is a factor instead of some long-term cycle in the oceans?
So at present, so there has only been two of these extreme El Nino events in the observational record, and there's just not enough to show statistically significantly that what we're seeing now is due to climate change. In terms of the future projection, so this is talking about climate model ensembles, and we're talking about, you know, I think kind of 35 different models that have each been run for 100 years. And I think in terms of the natural variability within these models, you don't anticipate each of these different models to have the natural variability in the same phase, do you understand what I mean? So if you picture something as an oscillation, if it's just naturally occurring with the climate system, it won't line up within each of these different models. So when you're looking at the ensemble, so all of the models together, this internal variability will be cancelled out.
It makes sense to me because it's where the word asymmetry comes in, which is we're looking for something here that doesn't fit a pattern. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically. So each of the models has its own internal variability, but it's obviously different in all of the models. So when you're looking across all of them, it basically disappears. And then what you're seeing, because the only common thread amongst each of these models is that they have been forced by increasing greenhouse gases.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with climate researcher Shane McGregor at Australia's Climate Research Centre in Sydney. And I'd like to follow up. That letter in Nature Climate Change also suggested that El Niños in the future could have profound social and economic impacts. We've touched on that a little bit, but can we go into a bit more detail on the predicted impacts in different parts of the world, say starting with America, and what about Australia and Europe? Does it affect Europe and South America?
Okay, so in terms of starting with the U.S., I actually think the El Nino events have reasonably good impacts for the U.S. I think most of California is currently in drought at the moment, and El Nino events generally lead to more rainfall than normal along the U.S. West Coast. And it also it's been linked to kind of milder winters, so kind of, not as cold winters for the U.S. In terms of rainfall for South America, it leads to kind of large-scale floods along much of the west coast of South America, which can be quite devastating. If we go then move along to the southwest Pacific, so off the east coast of Australia, it has dramatic impacts on tropical cyclones and where the cyclones actually form. So reasonably good news for Australia, that the number of cyclones that enter the Australian region is dramatically less during El Nino events. But what happens is these events, where they form, shifts further to the east, okay, and it allows them to form in regions over and around Fiji, Samoa, Tonga. So these regions are much more likely to be impacted by tropical cyclones during El Nino events. Australia in general, El Nino events lead to much drier conditions and much hotter conditions. So it has been linked to drought, large-scale drought over much of the east coast of Australia.
That sounds interesting, and especially about Australia, because you just had a record hot year in 2013. It's hard to imagine it getting much hotter, but it sounds like it could.
Yeah, that's true. And also 2013, currently at present, I think 50% of New South Wales and 80% of Queensland is currently drought declared. So, and this is in the absence of any kind of major El Nino event. So if an El Nino event was to come along this year and cause it to be even drier, I can't imagine it would be a good scenario for the farmers in those regions.
And can this weather system reach as far as Europe, or is it dissipated and other things are playing there?
I think it plays a less of a role, but it's definitely been linked to, I think, like the ski season and kind of rainfall and storminess in those regions. It's also linked to increased dryness over the Indian subcontinent. It kind of really has global effects. I think it's also even been linked. I think maybe the statistics and the number of events that you is kind of limited, but it's also been linked to rainfall along the east coast of Africa. So it does have like kind of globally reaching effects.
Well, scientists are famous for their uncertainty, and we've heard some of it in this interview. What are some of the things we don't know about El Nino that we'd like to know?
So I suppose one of the main things that we don't know that we'd like to know is how El Nino has reacted in the past. So basically, we've got really, really good observations of the tropical Pacific from about the mid-1980s until present day. This is kind of changing a little bit now. Our observational network is kind of going down a little bit at the moment. So we've got a really good observational network for about 20 to 30 years there. Prior to that, we kind of have reasonably good observations. So we're talking about kind of ship tracks for about the 30 years before that. So from about 1950 to 1960, we've got an idea of what was happening in the tropical Pacific. But it turns out when we look in these climate models, you kind of really need 500 or 600 years to really understand how much natural variability ENSO has in terms of its magnitudes and occurrence rates. And so definitely one of the main things we don't know, or one of the main things we need, is more observation and better observations, basically.
And we've talked about the oceans. Does the ocean water actually get hotter? Does El Nino affect ocean life as well?
Oh, it definitely affects ocean life. It has huge implications for kind of coral reefs and fisheries. So I think in terms of the U.S., I think in terms of California, so So basically when an El Nino happens off the west coast of South America, the warm waters warm up. And this allows a lot more tropical fish to kind of move further northwards. Some of the negative impacts of this are that the salmon in the Pacific Northwest suffer because kind of Pacific mackerel kind of can push northward along the coast, and they tend to eat the young salmon and compete with the adult salmon for food. So it has dramatic impacts on the salmon population. But also, I think from what I understand, commercial fishermen, or like sports fishermen, actually enjoy it a lot more because they get to catch a lot more different fish than what they would normally catch due to these warm waters.
And it's really bad for coral as well, as I understand it, which is already threatened in many places in the world.
Yeah, that's true. So I think most of the eastern half of the equatorial Pacific can generally get much warmer than normal, and it can lead to bleaching events kind of in these regions. I think at present, it's kind of the global warming is kind of already kind of increasing sea surface temperatures in these regions as well, increasing the occurrence of bleaching events. And this is just another thing kind of to add on to, have an impact on coral reefs.
So at what point in this year of 2014 would you feel confident saying, yes, we will have an El Nino this winter or next spring? When do you expect one?
I do expect one. And I was at a conference recently talking with a lot of other people that kind of are researching ENSO, and I think a large proportion of the community expect one. And I think, like I said, the probability of one occurring is estimated around 70%. As in terms of when I would be confident to say there's definitely going to be El Nino, it's probably not going to be until around September. But in saying that, I think it was September in 2012, sea surface temperatures had breached kind of El Nino thresholds, and it was on the verge of being declared an event, and then it just pretty much dissipated straight away. So that was the first time that had happened in the kind of very limited observational record. So in the last kind of 30 or 40 years, that's the first time that had actually been observed to happen, like an event kind of really start and look like it was going to go and then stop. So I think come September, I think we'll have much more of an idea. So once we get through this, the Northern Hemisphere winter, or the American winter, we'll have much better ideas, and the models will also give us much better information in regards to the potential amplitude of the event.
Is there anything that I've missed that you think the public ought to know about this powerful weather machine?
I suppose one of the biggest things is while we do have a pretty good understanding of how it operates, we're still learning about it, and we really need to keep up our observations of the tropical Pacific, and this includes many measures, so like satellite observations, and at the moment there's an array of buoys that are kind of moored in the tropical Pacific, and I think there's 70-plus buoys moored around the tropical Pacific at present. And the thing is, from about 1994, this array network has been fully functional and it's been operating about 90% capacity. But in the last 2 years, it's kind of been underserviced. And the amount of data that is returning from this network is about 40. So of those 70, roughly kind of 20 to 30 of them are actually sending information back to us at the moment. So it's looking like it's going to be a little bit precarious. I think we really need to keep investing in this observational network.
We've been talking with Dr. Shane McGregor. He's a research fellow at Australia's Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. You can find links to the science and news we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. You can also find this interview on Radio EcoShock's sound page after a few days, and you can pass it on to other people from there. Dr. McGregor, thank you so much for spending time with our listeners.
Okay, thanks a lot for having us, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Will El Nino finally be the weather disaster that jolts humans and their governments out of denial? There is plenty of fear, real and imagined, to go around. In the May 7th edition of New Scientist magazine, under the headline, "World is unprepared for major El Nino later this year," Michael Slezak writes, quote, "The weather is preparing to go wild and will wreak havoc and death around the globe later this year. An El Nino, a splurge of warm water in the Pacific Ocean, is coming. It will unleash floods in the Americas, while Southeast Asia and Australia face drought. Yet little is being done to address these consequences," end quote. He then goes on to quote Axel Timmerman from the University of Hawaii that the tropical system is ready to fling a big El Nino at us. The last large El Nino of 1997-98, he tells us, killed 20,000 people and cost $97 billion in damage. Scientists and meteorologists, Slezak reports, are worried in private but don't want to cause a public panic. The same New Scientist magazine also carries an editorial warning that overly cautious scientists may be endangering the world. Quote, "The effects of the huge El Niño of the 1990s were all the worse because cautious forecasts didn't allow people to prepare. It shouldn't happen again. A major El Niño is massing in the Pacific Ocean and is likely to cause cyclones, tornadoes, droughts, floods, and sea level changes across the world. Many leading scientists say the approaching El Niño looks similar in magnitude to the huge one that started in 1997 and went on to kill tens of thousands of people and cause tens of billions of dollars in damage. But you won't hear that sort of warning from official forecasters. They agree that an El Niño is likely, but are saying little about its potential strength," end quote from New Scientist magazine. Also warning of bad things to come is Joe Rome, the former Clinton energy advisor and honored parent of the Climate Progress blog, one of the top sources for climate information on the planet. The headline of his article published May 8th is, "El Niño chances to jump to near 80%, add in global warming and we face record heat." Joe Rome writes, "If this El Niño does start fairly quickly and become quite strong, as many currently expect, then 2014 could well become the hottest year on record, and 2015 would likely break all previous global records," end quote. I think he's right, but we have to be careful about what we believe and what we can prove so far with science. I thought, and still believe, that starting out with a hotter world, this next El Niño, whenever it comes, can create startling changes in the world. Let me explain that and why I could be wrong. Common sense tells me that warming could make El Niño more powerful, more damaging. Why? Two reasons. First, the oceans are heating up as incremental heat is transferred to the seas. And remember, more of the sea is exposed to the sun as the Arctic loses sea ice for longer periods, but we'll call that a small effect for now. But overall, around the world, the oceans are soaking in more heat. El Niño, we know, is driven by hotter oceans. Second, we know more water vapor is being held in the atmosphere with warming. There is at least 4% more water up there, some say 7%, than there was in 1970. El Niño is partly about the transfer of rains from the western Pacific further east, possibly all the way to California and the west coast of South America. What would have been natural flooding may become supercharged extreme rainfall events with El Niño's help. While all that's probably true, I've checked with several scientists who are emphatic there is no science so far to show that climate change has made El Niño stronger. Our guest Shane McGregor, who is an expert in the field, says so. I also phoned Dr. Matthew England, the Deputy Director of the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. He's part of a team of scientists who recently published an important paper on El Niño. Dr. England said recent science shows El Niño events will likely become more common as the world warms. This global weather disturbance may come every 10 years instead of every 20 years. But there is no evidence that global warming has made El Niño more intense than it was, say, 1,000 or even 70,000 years ago. My impression is we have to separate the idea of El Niño, the giant oceanic swing state, from things like hurricanes and other storms. El Niño is not a storm. Matthew England said there is little doubt that hurricanes, known as tropical cyclones in the southern hemisphere, will become more violent as warming develops further over the next decades. Again, the science doesn't say there will necessarily be more hurricanes or typhoons, but when they do come, the extra sea heat and water vapor will likely give us things like Super Typhoon Haiyan, which raked part of the Philippines flat in November 2013, or nasty and expensive storms like Hurricane Sandy last year. El Niño is just the opposite. We have science saying there will be more El Niño events, but no proof they will be stronger. Still, I'm sticking to my common sense view, apparently echoed by Joe Rome, that if we begin a warming event from an already hot world, it will be worse. We'll have to wait and see as the global experiment with weather develops in the coming years. I started out by saying El Niño and the whole cycle of the Pacific called ENSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, is hard to grasp. That's because it's not a particular thing, but a complicated large-scale system of things. We humans have trouble with global cycles that only show up every decade or two. Our attention span is smaller, and shorter than that. What we can understand easily is this. The more prevalent partner to El Niño is La Niña, the girl child in Spanish. La Niña, with its cooler mix of ocean waters, has operated like a massive air conditioner for the world. La Niña is one of the factors which masks the actual warming we are creating with our excess greenhouse gas emissions. With El Niño, we expect the air conditioner will be run in reverse, releasing some of the heat built up in the ocean. We may, as Joe Rome warns, experience the heat we are creating daily. It could be a record hot year globally in 2015 or even this year if El Niño shows up in full strength. It's like an audition for the future. That doesn't necessarily mean you won't be cold next winter. El Niño has been known for milder winters in the Northern Hemisphere. But there are other factors at work. Another huge change in the planetary weather system due to abnormal heating in the Arctic. The jet stream has been altered, scientists tell us, which may have brought the stalled polar vortex of cold air over most of North America last winter, even while the Arctic was much hotter than it usually is. The jet stream change has happened in the southern hemisphere as well, Matthew England told me. Winds that used to bring rain to Australia have moved further south toward the pole. They may never return in thousands of years. That is why the major city of Perth, Australia, had to spend $2 billion on a desalinization plant to get enough water to survive as a city. The same thing may be coming for California. We have no idea how the changed jet stream will interact with El Niño. That's what happens when we mess with the global scale climate systems. The weather becomes a crapshoot and the odds are against us. I know many of you are expecting, not hoping for, but expecting, some major sign of climate change that will finally push the public into demanding action. Will it be El Niño this year or next? I doubt it. There will be plenty of flashy weather porn reported in the news. Maybe 10 or 30,000 people will die. If they're not Americans or Europeans, we don't care much. Even when 30,000 Europeans died in the heat wave of 2003, nobody marched in the streets protesting inaction on fossil fuels. The El Niño of 1997-98 was a disaster for the atmosphere. It occurred at the same time when farmers and corporations in Indonesia were clearing and burning forests on a grand scale for palm oil plantations and simple logging. Giant areas of peat were exposed, dried, and burned. Suddenly, Indonesia, hardly a major industrial country, vaulted up to about third place among global carbon emitters. The peat fires buried Asia in smoke and pumped a giant burst of carbon into the atmosphere. All that carbon is still there. It pushes down the accelerator on warming, but the public hardly knows about it. Ask around. They don't know. El Niño will add to the background of worry. It will change some minds. But if you are counting on this boy child, literally the Christ child in Spanish, as a turning point to save the world, don't. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
With an ear for solutions, Radio EcoShock continues our long-running series on home permaculture and backyard gardening. Next, we visit Calgary, Canada, which just hit national news for their snowfall in May. Luke Kimmel is one of the leaf ninjas, fostering green jobs and local food there. Luke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's a pleasure.
What are the leaf ninjas? Tell us about your project.
Sure. So the leaf ninjas, we're four entrepreneurs in our mid-20s. We're all born and raised in Calgary, and we're really passionate about giving back to this city through being involved in the local food movement. So specifically, we do edible landscaping, where we consult on and design, install, and maintain edible landscapes, largely focused on food forestry. And then we've operated our urban farm for the last 2 years, on borrowed land in some inner-city communities, where we then grow produce on that land and sell it to farmers markets and restaurants.
So, Luke, a key part of this story for me is the way young people can create their own jobs with alternative urban growing. How did you get started, and how did this morph into a successful business?
That's a great question. It's one I do speak more and more on these days, as we've actually, 4 years later, found some success in it. But it's a rocky road, and I would say that we took a really grassroots approach. This was not our first business, so this is actually my third or fourth business venture that I've been involved in, and so I did have some kind of entrepreneurial tact. I did prepare a couple of things. The main things that we did really were get involved in our community, so as soon as I discovered kind of the value of land and wanting to get reconnected with food and things like that, I got involved with the local community and found some mentors. And I really did everything I could to earn their respect and get around them and spend time with them and glean some knowledge. So that entailed a whole summer of basically volunteering my weekends to attend these garden installations and learn as much as I could on the ground. You know, and then on top of that, just attending courses and workshops, and then I did some volunteer design for some friends, and then that went okay. And then I slowly started charging just small fees for doing design, to the point now where we're basically up there with any other landscaping company in the city doing this professionally.
How many people do you employ?
We employ the four partners of Leaf Ninjas. So Leaf Ninjas is four partners, and then we have one full-time employee and a variety of subcontractors that we work with on a kind of project-to-project basis.
Can you make enough money spring to fall to stay alive during the long Canadian winter?
Yes, we figured that out. I think we're just getting there this year. For us, the landscaping and design approach really stood out as being something that wasn't being offered as a service in Calgary and something there was high demand for. So we just really paid attention to the different niches that were available in the market and identified that one and have gone with it. And I think for anybody doing this kind of work, if you can find ways to diversify, like for us, for example, we've begun a propagation program where a lot of the plants that we'd love to grow here, like Good King Henry and Giant Solomon Seal, very difficult to buy or impossible to buy as plant material. We have to grow it out from seed. So that's turned into an income stream for us. Another one is the speaking and teaching. So as soon as you've, you know, found some things out through being on the ground and getting that hands-on experience, then being able to pass that on and share that value with other people through teaching. So diversifying in the income stream is kind of key, just like it is to diversify in the garden.
Those are good tips. So Luke, what is spin farming?
Spin farming, it stands for small plot intensive, and it's basically urban-focused practice for organic growing, where the whole model is based on farms that are an acre or an acre and a half in size max. Our urban farm was never bigger than half an acre. And I think the model really succeeds because it's based on you don't have to own land, and you just own your own tools and equipment. And we borrowed land, and this is what spin farmers typically do. They borrow land in the city, whether it's open backyards or big front yards or entire empty lots, and then that land is given in exchange for a share in the produce. And really, we see the homeowners that have lent us land get a lot of value just simply out of helping out with this initiative and feeling like they, even though they're not in the garden growing the produce, they have a huge hand in supporting the urban agriculture movement, and that, you know, allows people to feel like they're doing something, and they really are.
Do spin farmers in Calgary work together, or is it all competitive?
Well, when we got going, there was one other spin farming company that was doing it professionally. So we were the second, and now there's nine companies that are urban farming this year in Calgary. So we're very blessed in that the scene here, you know, whether it's spin farming or permaculture, it's generally very cooperative. We have a strong market here in Calgary where people are willing to pay for a lot of these services. So there's kind of enough fish in the sea that we can have a collaborative approach. We've actually helped develop and mentor some of these farmers, the new farmers coming up this year and last year. And we've created an organization called the YYC Growers and Distributors. And this is a network of these urban spin farmers combined with some rural farmers. And together we're putting together a CSA, so the Community Supported Agriculture. And we've seen a lot of buy-in from people with that. And that's helped a lot of these new farmers, you know, not have to buy a rototiller, or not have to buy the walk-in cooler, and share their resources amongst each other, which has just been fantastic and so rewarding to see.
You know, I saw a photo of Geneva backyards, and there was not a lawn to be seen. It was fence-to-fence gardening and food growing, and apparently they cooperate and tell each other, well, I'll grow this and you grow that. What's your vision for backyard farming in North American cities?
Well, one thing that I really hope for is that this can become, well, and I see it, that it is becoming a respected thing. People think this is cool, it's new, and they get that we need to make some shifts in our overall culture, and they see this as being one positive way that we can do that that's very accessible. So I see this becoming more normal, and I do see people, you know, of any walk of life recognizing that quality food comes from locally grown sources, and there's a huge correlation there. So I think that as more people, you know, of all walks of life, the professionals that we do their gardens in downtown, they know that the tomato tastes better from the vine than it does from the store. And the young people who see that, wow, you know, there's some other young folks out there that have, you know, not had to follow the mold and go do the university thing or just work in a full-time career. They've been able to make something for themselves from working with the land, and that's cool. So I do see this becoming more normal and actually something that's sought after.
Luke, you just went through a punishing long winter. I know there are melts occasionally from the famous warm winds in Calgary called the Chinook, but even that break can be a problem for plants that are exposed to the next sub-zero cold snap. And I haven't mentioned the infamous hailstorms that has Calgary gardeners operating a Twitter alert service to cover up. And backyards, you need a pickaxe to dig the soil up the first time. How the heck can you grow food in Calgary?
Well, that's like many things. When we take the permaculture approach, we can turn a problem into a solution. And for us, people believe that you can't grow anything in Calgary. And that gives us shock value when all of a sudden we have a plant list of over, you know, 50 to 100 species that we use and work readily in this climate. I think the key things are basically site selection comes down to be a huge thing. Because you're right, it is a very, very harsh climate. And if we just go out into the middle of a prairie and try and start a garden where we're exposed to these harsh winds and we're not getting excess rainfall or irrigation, I mean, it's going to be difficult to grow much of anything in that kind of a site. But when we look at these urban environments, and particularly if we can find south-facing microclimates that are sheltered from sort of the north and west winds, then just through selecting the right site, we can, you know, jump ahead from that zone 2-3 growing condition to maybe even a 4-5. So there's a big sway just based on that. Some of the other things are just what species we're selecting. I mean, we're huge fans here of the sea buckthorn, the sea berry. Grows just about in any soil and very, very hardy, produces that amazing berry. The green and red aurax, the mountain spinach, sunchoke. So choosing these really hardy species. And again, diversity. Like if some of our greens or our rhubarb or whatever gets destroyed by the hail, there's a higher chance that if we had trees growing over that and some shrubs, that force is going to be dissipated. And then, of course, things like greenhouses do make a ton of sense in this climate. And we get more and more into that as the years go on.
Yeah, the past winter was brutally cold for most of North America. Luke Kimmel, how can home gardeners protect their perennial plants and trees from the polar vortex?
One thing that we noticed massive success from this year was anywhere that the snow was piling. So even if you're putting up temporary snow fencing or using a crop like sunchoke or even sunflower and leaving those stalks up over the winter and you're getting some kind of snow catchment, we found that snow mulch, even if it was 4 to 6 inches, in areas where that mulch stuck around, our clovers and strawberries, the other ground covers, some of these herbaceous perennials are popping up out of the ground already, whereas sites where there was no snow cover are bare and very dry and dead-looking. So if you can bury the plants in snow, or even a leaf mulch or any brought-in mulch, I think that's going to, especially in the early season, help you get a head start.
Another great tip. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with Luke Kimmel, part of the local business called the Leaf Ninjas in the Western Canadian city of Calgary. Some of the heavy work around there gets done with a permablitz. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm hugely passionate about the permablitz, or sometimes as we call them, garden blitzes. So basically there's three parties that come together to make a permablitz happen. You have the homeowner who supplies all the costs, provides food and beverages for the volunteers throughout the day. Then there's a designer who's been hired to create a design, a permaculture design for the site, and they're going to facilitate the volunteers and educate them, inform them about what to do, how to install that garden properly, and they're responsible for providing leadership and education. And then the volunteers show up, and really they get fed an amazing meal, beverages and snacks throughout the day, and then they get to have some hands-on experience in the garden, and as well as this guided leadership, and we definitely take breaks and do kind of workshop-style education with a whiteboard around specific things in the garden. So it's really a win-win-win all the way around. The homeowner saves a ton of money. It's one of the only very low, you know, low-commitment, low-risk opportunities for people to actually get hands-on experience in the garden without having their own garden. And it's great for us as well, as facilitators.
A couple of other projects I've heard about in Calgary. One is called The Verge. What is that?
So So Verge Permaculture, ran by Rob and Michelle Avis, they've been huge mentors of ours. And, I mean, it comes back to how we got involved in the community. And I chased Rob around Western Canada, followed him to all of his speaking events and all his workshops, and eventually convinced him to let me work for him for a seven-month period. But these guys are amazing, and they're both ex-mechanical engineers who worked in the oil and gas industry in Calgary and have now transitioned into studying permaculture and teaching permaculture. And, I mean, their course and their mentorship, their leadership, like, there's no way we would be here if they hadn't been that pioneer species kind of readying the ground and making way for, really, they've made the way for a handful of probably over a dozen entrepreneurs through their courses and workshops who have been able to now run their own businesses.
What is their names again? I missed that.
It's Rob and Michelle Avis with Verge Permaculture.
You know, I got to be honest, Calgary's known as the oil capital of Canada. It's got lots of offices for tar sands corporations. It's a city of giant pickup trucks. But Calgarians just elected Canada's first Muslim mayor and has a surprisingly vibrant alternative community. How do those two go together?
It's the closet greenies. It's everybody who works and makes their living, you know, doing something for the industry or finance or IT or whatever it is. But then I think at the end of the day, people are still left with this question of, like, how do we fit in this planet? And they recognize that the messaging is just keeps coming up, that there needs to be a shift, there needs to be a shift. And so I see that a lot of these folks still working in these industries want to do something in their spare time, like have a garden. Personally, I'm very passionate about connecting with that exact niche and helping them do that. Because I think it's one of those small steps.
An important one. So you get your local city farm produce. How do you get it to consumers, especially if some people are sold on big supermarkets or Walmart? How do you get what you grow out there?
Holy. Well, that's one of the biggest challenges that I think the urban farmers face, is that for people to engage and get this produce, it often requires a bit of a shift from their usual shopping habit. What do I say about that? I mean, the CSA is really a great model for that, because it's a weekly pickup where, well, basically, for anyone that doesn't know, it's a community-supported agriculture where people put up money at the front of at the beginning of the year and buy basically a share in the farm, and then they get a delivery for anywhere from, in Calgary, 17 to 20 weeks usually, max, sometimes 25 for the really good farmers. That's probably one of the best ways. And then the other thing is that we have some community organizations, community associations that have really established and very successful farmers markets, namely Hillhurst Sunnyside has done an amazing job. Their market is very well attended. And we found for us that when we attended that market, sold our produce, that it was one of the most well-received and we did the best financially there.
So for listeners who are warming up to the idea of a permaculture yard, what would it look like?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I mean, I'm answering this question kind of day in, day out. And the first thing that I always stop people on and say is, you know what, we've really got to examine our goals. Because we deal with a wide set of goals. I mean, some people are really concerned about the aesthetics, and that's the primary thing. But they come to us because they want the meaning of having a sustainable food-producing garden. So the plant choices for them is going to be very different than someone who says, I want to be producing as much of my own food as possible. You know, some people want to relax in their garden. Some people want exercise. Some people want privacy, and other people want to educate and bring in the community. So I'd say, first of all, it really depends. It really depends on the goals. But in general, what our gardens end up looking like is we incorporate rainwater harvesting, so all the water off of the roof or a driveway is diverted into the landscape through a series of either terraces or basins, swales, dry creek beds. And that kind of forms the backbone for the garden, especially with the dry creek bed. It has that beautiful, natural, yet landscaped aesthetic. And then other than that, we're working with basically a forest-like system. It looks like a young savanna, a young woodland ecosystem. So we've got the fruit trees, generally along the north sides kind of the house, that cascade down into hedgerows of shrubs that may be placed for privacy, and then the herbaceous layers of the horseradish, comfrey, hostas, rhubarb. And as much as we can, we actually work with common landscaping plants, such as the ostrich fern and the hosta. People's eyes are already trained to recognize these plants as beautiful landscaping plants, and, you know, little do they know they were also edible. So it can be very beautiful, but it also really does shift based on the individual goals of the homeowner or the client.
Wait a minute. Can you eat a hosta?
You can, yeah. You can eat the young shoot of the hosta. So it's you would eat it in the same way that you would eat asparagus or the Solomon seal, where you pick the young shoot and then you let it grow out and become that beautiful plant later on in the year.
Almost like the ferns we used to pick in Ontario. You had to get them when they first came up and then maybe fry them in butter or something. But if you left them any later than that, they were not so good for you.
Yeah, exactly. So we do work with those ferns as well, the ostrich fern.
When you talk to new customers, why do you think more people are ready to transition from the lawn culture to this home permaculture?
I see that people come to this through many avenues, and I mean, health and wellness is one, where a lot of the narratives around health and wellness right now point towards quality food, and you know, people are recognizing that quality food inherently is food locally grown a lot of times, grown organically. So there's the health and wellness aspect, there's the climate change piece where people are concerned and they want to do something. And having a home garden is just one step to help ease the weight that we put onto the industrial food system. And spiritual reasons as well, social reasons where people want to have, you know, a space that they can invite their friends and family into and have a feeling of sanctuary. So for us, we get everywhere from the kind of anarchist approach all the way to the other side of the spectrum, which is, I work full-time and I'm busy, I just want to have a nice garden. But I find it very interesting how we deal with such a wide spectrum of people, and the garden is that common ground that we're finding.
You've created a longing in me. I'll put some links to the ideas and organizations we've talked about in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. Luke, please tell our listeners where they can find the Leaf Ninjas online.
All right, we're at www.leafninjas.ca, and we're also very active on our social media on Facebook, facebook.com/CalgaryLeafNinjas, and our Instagram as well, instagram.com/LeafNinjas. Those are probably some of the best places to keep updated with our work.
And now I'm going to show my age. What really is Instagram for?
It's one of the fastest working social media, where people are often just taking pictures and posting them from mobile devices. So we'll do that, where we'll post a picture of a piece of work we've just done, or some food we've just harvested or something like that. And there's a lot of really great gardeners and permaculturists that are using that tool, and it just does help to make it a little bit cooler to do this kind of stuff and to show that value in a really easy way.
Well, I could see it could be handy. I mean, you've got a leaf of a plant. You're wondering, what's this? Or maybe even an insect. Has anybody seen this? You could just share it that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've been talking about local food ideas that work with Luke Kimmel of the Leaf Ninjas in Calgary, Canada. Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure, Alex. Thank you for all your work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. On Radio EcoShock, we broadcast through many college stations as part of my outreach to the younger generation who will live through climate change. I'm going to announce a competition to write modern music about climate change. You can get in early with details in this week's show blog at ecoshock.info. There's a free download of climate quotes any podcaster, broadcaster, or songwriter can use. ecoshock.info for the details. Meanwhile, here's a short tune I wrote last week while toiling away at this program. It's called Heal Me. You can listen again or download my music and this program, all on the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. It's catching on fast. Check it out. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.